Thank you very much. And before I welcome the questions from the panel to these two great talks about two different indications of the NOACs, atrial fibrillation trials and ACS, I want to extend a welcome to both the Ukraine participants that are on the web and China, and certainly also from the Russian center with the doctor chaired by Vladimir Popov and Juliana Isakova, Ukraine by Katerina Sashenkova, and also in China by Dr. Yang Hu. So welcome also to Peking. Panel, there are a lot of provocative comments here. Trials that have failed, not failed. Any comments to the two presenters? George.
I want to open the gate. So, adaptive design, it's very logical, it's a forward step, but it's not very easy for me to construct. Two concerns are for me important regarding this type of trials. First, because we are able to modify the eligibility criteria and do also a blinded interim analysis, how are we confident in interpreting the efficacy results because of the nature and type of data are changing? This is a question I want to address to all the panel. In 2010, the FDA had a draft on the modalities in applying adaptive designs, but especially for the trials with antithrombotic drugs, this is very important. And the second concern, so the first is how to interpret the final results in a trial in which we modify inside the trial the eligibility criteria and other criteria like dosage. Second, different from traditional drug development programs, adaptive trials are shorter. This shorter period could have implication on the safety because it lacks the time to observe some negative results. So I'll launch this discussion to all the panel.
We have a question from the right also.
So thank you very much for taking Petro and Rely as an example for the use of adaptive design. Just one remark, I would say that Petro was followed by a Petro extension, and you mentioned it. So basically the data are not only of the dose selection, it's not only driven from the 12 weeks, but also from information coming from the extension. The second point that I would like to mention is that from the company information about the 110 milligram, we know that this dose affect coagulation parameters to the similar extent to, for instance, xmilagatran. And we know that xmilagatran, when it was tested in sportive, it was more or less non-inferior to warfarin. So there is a rationale to include the 110. It means I like adaptive design in some aspects, but I wish I have my discussion slides at the same time. I will come back to that later on. I think when you want to combine phase 2B and 3, there are a lot of risks and limitations that need to be considered, and probably we can discuss this later.
I think Nancy had a comment, and then in the corner after.
So when you undertake an adaptive design, you actually, somebody who makes a decision about the continuation takes an unblinded look, and that's both a pro and a con. So when somebody takes an unblinded look, the decision is based on that, and the decision itself can be revealing to the ongoing trial, and that's kind of too bad because that could have a negative effect, certainly on everybody's, perhaps even on accrual, on everybody's view toward the continuation. But the adaptive look is not a blinded look. And that's, again, an advantage. Then when you combine that part of the trial with the other part of the trial, it's done differently than in the conventional interim analysis. And the other thing I want to address is the change in the population. If you do that, or drop the arms, your conclusion is going to be about what the final trial was. That's the conclusion you get to draw. Whether, you know, that's diluted by virtue of having chosen a subgroup or eliminated a dose, that's something else. But you do, the population on which you draw the conclusion is well defined.
So we have, is that a, Martin, is that a comment directly to Nancy? Then we'll go, okay. Then please, Martin Simons. Let's take the...
It should be on. Well, I'll try. Nancy, you indicated that the thrombotic field would not be optimal for this adaptive design. Can you give examples of where this design has worked?
Cancer.
That's in very small patient groups in completely other disease?
No, in cancer you have a pretty good surrogate endpoint, which is response. So if tumor shrinks... If the tumor doesn't shrink, it's a bad thing. So basically, there's a good relationship between tumor response and survival so that you can base an adaptive design on response, which is a short-term endpoint and makes good sense.
Okay. Yeah. Question in the corner.
It's Lloyd Haskell from Janssen Pharmaceuticals. Just a couple of comments, questions. I didn't hear anything about statistical penalties in an adaptive design. I think that's something that needs to be discussed, too. I look forward to the regulatory opinion of adaptive design in cardiovascular trials, because although I've never approached the FDA directly with an adaptive design, when they think it's an adaptive design, we get some strange looks. And also, I just want to make a comment about cancer. I think cancer and cardiovascular trials are very different, as everybody on the panel knows. I mean, phase 3 in cancer is smaller than phase 2 in cardiovascular. And I'm very concerned about, particularly in heart failure, although it's not specific to heart failure, there's been so many drugs that did extraordinarily well in phase 2 and then completely showed an increase in mortality, for example, in phase 3. So I'd like those kind of questions addressed by the panel.
Nancy, do you want to respond? Also, I need, could you extend your, answer that question, but also explain to me, maybe I'm not bright enough, but in cancer, it would seem to me that although tumor shrinks, there is also a safety issue, the same that we see when we work with antithrombotic drugs. It might have deleterious effects on other organs and unwanted side effects. But so two questions I get in one.
Yeah. So first, the good news. On the penalty for an adaptive design, that's kind of interesting because in some of the designs, if you get a results that look good, so like a p-value less than 0.15 in your first look, then you actually get greater than 0.05 in your second look. So there's no penalty. In fact, there's a benefit. But if you get a large p-value, of course, there is a penalty, just as there is for taking interim looks at the data. So there's good news and bad news, and of course we're all gamblers when we're trying to test new drugs. So that's.
But I think I brought it up because in one of your slides you mentioned it may not increase the sample size. But
well, if you dropped arms at that interim look, then you in your interim look would be taken, say at I don't know, 18,000 in RELY, so at less than half. So you would not have to continue those arms, and you would never get to the total sample size that you originally projected. But I also wanted to address the question of long-term problems. Short-term trials don't answer the question of long-term problems. I'm sorry, that's life. If I mean, you know, we have these terrible examples, whether it's Avandia or Celebrex. Short-term trials and maybe even phase three may not address the long-term problems if they're rare enough events. It's true in heart. It's true in cancer. Where, you know, this isn't magic. That's life.
Can I add one word of caution? What we also see is people are lumping together meta-analyses. The dose-finding data from phase two into conclusions about the safety of these drugs. So in a recent meta-analysis that was published, I think it was in the Annals or Archives, they took all the failed doses in phase two that had excess bleeding and said these drugs cause, you know, whopping amounts of excess bleeding. Well, that's the goal in phase two, to define the bleeding. And, you know, so I would say, if you begin to do this adaptive design and include all that bleeding data as part of your experience, these meta-analytic people are going to go crazy and really include a lot of failed doses in their analyses.
You're bringing up a very nice unsolved statistical problem, how these new designs affect meta-analysis and how meta-analysis should be adjusted in order to compensate for that. I mean, you know, my first reaction is that those failed doses could be left out of the meta-analysis. You're then answering a different question.
Right. You leave them out, but then you can't necessarily answer. I mean, you could keep them in the efficacy side, but we should all agree that that shouldn't be included in the safety assessment.
It depends on what the question is.
Yeah.
You want to address the drug?
They
or
turned
do you,
you off.
I'm talking too much. or do you want to answer the question about the doses you finally decided on? Those are different questions. And presumably there'd be more trials than the phase two and the phase three. You do things like then, I hope, following the decision that an anticoagulant or an antithrombotic works, that you then tested with additional drugs. So there should be other data as well.
Well, I would say that we, in a meta-analysis, we want to look at, guide us in our interpretation and decision-making about doses that are actually going to be used in clinical practice, not failed doses in phase two. And I see that as a flaw in some of the analyses.
From the statistical point of view, if we want, there are two different problems, the dosage and the sample size. From the statistical point of view, if we want to modify the sample size, increasing or decreasing I don't think is a very happy solution, but increasing, we should have an absolutely blinded interim analysis, not unblinded. We should have a blinded one. Because if we have an unblinded interim analysis, we should modify the statistical criteria. And in any case, I see a huge increase in false positive results with such kind of design.
Okay, it depends on what you look at. So in the warfarin trial, COAG, which is ongoing, we did an interim analysis to see if our estimate of variance was correct. And so that does not affect, so you can increase sample size. Decreasing sample size has problems. It affects the type 1 error. You have to be a little bit careful. So if you just make sure you're checking on some parameters you use to estimate your sample size, that won't affect the type 1 error. If you do an unblinded look at the data, there are some techniques where you compensate by adjusting the p-value. And it, as I say, the problem is who knows how much is revealed by that interim look, not the statistical aspects of it, which do protect the type 1 error. So there are a whole potpourri of methods for adaptive design now. And I think you just have to be careful that you're doing a legitimate one, not one I mean, we used to just look at the data and say, oh, let's make the trial bigger, but we don't do it that way anymore.
So Roxana Marin had a question.
So my comment is to challenge us a little bit about how to improve and enhance our phase two trials. And can we actually, and this becomes a little bit of a more difficult, I think, statistical question, in dropping and finding the right dose earlier on, rather than, in other words, bringing in the adaptive design into the phase two trial. And is that a more creative way to handle this? I know that in the aptamer studies that we did with Reg 1, we used this particular methodology. Now, one doesn't know if the right dose was actually chosen for reversal agent, but you can use these sensitive parameters to understand which dose doesn't work well, perhaps enhance your sample sizes and decrease the multiple 20-arm studies in phase two to be more precise in an adaptive way in phase two, and then move into your phase three. I wonder if our statisticians and others feel that is this a better way to deal with the phase two trials?
Anybody want to respond? Nancy?
Are there any other statisticians who can respond? Respond. So yes, you can do that. You can use an adaptive design in phase two without combining it with phase three. I guess a little bit of my concern is it's not going to be so efficient. So I think it makes your phase two longer. Because when you make a decision to drop, then you have to continue for some reason. And I'm not sure what the... you want to continue to look at bleeding? Okay, in another look. I don't see how that's going to make you more efficient, whereas the combination of phase two and phase three, I think, would make you more efficient. I don't think you should introduce a brand new dose in the after the adaptation that you haven't looked at before. I just think there's not a basis for that in the framework I'm thinking about in adaptive design. But you could use adaptive designs in phase two. But I mean, you want to look at 12 weeks and drop some arms. Well, anything you do at 12 weeks in antithrombotics, it may be right and it may be wrong. I think it's premature to look. So the disadvantage of using adaptive designs in phase two is you have to make the phase two longer. So you have to take a first look later than 12 weeks, and then you have to have a reason you're continuing. I mean, you don't want to take 9 of the 20 doses into phase three. So you really are going to continue until you eliminate more.
Okay, I think
I want to go backwards a little bit, back to the era of lytics, and Martin will remember some of this, that we would often gallop through the very early phases of phase two of doses to get to what we expected to be reasonable doses. But one technique we used statistically, which was very effective, is what's called sequential probability testing, looking for these infrequent catastrophic events, not after large numbers of patients, but after every single patient. We would look to see, are we in the green zone of okay? Are we in the yellow zone? Are we out of bounds with what we would predict based upon 95% confidence intervals for fatal events or catastrophic events like ICH? So it's a technique that I would urge you to think about when you're dealing with these catastrophic events like ICH. It's called sequential probability testing, and you're looking at every single patient and whether you are violating your assumptions continuously throughout phase two, rather than taking these interim, you're taking a nearly continuous interim look in this technique.
Can I just make a quick comment about this issue? from a practical perspective, and again, I thought a lot about adaptive designs, and we've never done any because of concerns, particularly with regulatory agencies. But I think when we do our discussions internally, I think What it turns out to become is that you're combining phase two and phase three. You're not really presenting a phase three trial with an adaptive design. Because I think it's, as we all know, probably the hardest thing to do in drug development is picking the right dose. And you can't really, unless you know an awful lot about your drug before you do the trial, it's very difficult to do a standard type of adaptive design. And again, what we would do is that we would look at a X number of doses in a phase two and then run it into a phase three. So we save time from an administrative perspective. But you really, to do a phase, a really adaptive design and skip phase two, I think, in this regulatory environment is very, very challenging.
You're not skipping phase two. I think what you're doing is an adaptive design.
But it's an adaptive design, but we would call it phase two running into phase three.
That is indeed an adaptive design. If my friends at the FDA don't like that, well.
So again, I'd like to hear the regulatory view of this, because when, as I said earlier, when we brought designs or ideas to them and they say it's adaptive design, they look at you funny. But I don't think. And as I said, getting back, unless you know an awful lot about your drug, to really do a, you know, take three doses maybe into a phase three and then drop it to one might be very challenging and from a numerical perspective. That's the only comment I want to say.
Okay, we have a number of people on the list. First, it's York Coughlin, and then it's Mr. Godin. And then I think I'll invite Peter de Graaf who have some slides to put up the administrator's viewpoint, if you so wish. So, please.
Well, I think the discussion already moves into the direction where my question was going. So we understand the efficiencies of adaptive designs, smaller sample sizes, perhaps quicker decision-making while data evolves. But that's not the only guiding post when you put together a development plan from phase one through phase three. So your other guiding post is, and do I meet regulatory requirements? So when you have an adaptive design, there is some level of unblinding. Nancy talked to that, and so I'm looking forward to Peter's and then other opinions. How do you really balance efficiencies of adaptive designs with the need to at least keep your final phase three pivotal data set as blinded as possible? What is acceptable from a regulatory point of view and what's not acceptable?
Yes, Christophe Godin, Sanofi. I would like to know up to which point the limitations which are raised on adaptive design are not mainly due to the limitation of phase two. I mean, we know the difficulty of predicting from phase two to phase three depends on the value of the surrogates which are used. It depends on the amount of data which is collected during the phase two. And we are trying to, on top of these uncertainties in this discussion, to think about adaptive design and maybe combining phase two and phase three. And I'm just wondering if it's not the main limitation, while adaptive design in a phase three study is something probably very different. And we have maybe the opportunity to comment later on that.
Thank you very much. So we now, of course, move into...